Jigba da jomba yanda ba zobe sanje jigba da chapso temba devara jigba jigde jibo dewe galo jowa lana meba lada menamje temba sanje jomde pejawa shaja duba la chaze lo chodo chapso jigo temba jomde deje jigba da jomba ya Zobe Sanje Rigpa Dan Shabso Denpa Dewara Shikpa Jigden Genpa Jibu Dube Kalo Lana Meba Lada Menam Jidunpa Sanje Chumden De Pejewa Shaja Tuba La Chaze Lo Chundu Cheo Dunpa Chumden De Dijin Shikpa Tachumpa Yandapa Zobe Sanje Rigpa Dan Shabso Denpa Dewara Jibu Dube Kalu Jorwa Lana Meba Lada Menam Jidunpa Sanje Chumden De Pejawa Shaja Tuba La Chudu Jabzu Che Hoi Gumbu Jidun Jambi Yangla Shadze Lo Kange Lo Tu Timne Tinte Nyinda Anamda Rabze Chini Dungun Chishin Sishin Niki Tuga Lekpa Madzi Kanda Sibi Tsura Mare Dumu Donye Gizi Chodzo Gwela Puji Dazi Yenla Chuju Yande Su Chudara Chedro Nyumu Nilun Legi Chadro Chuzi Chi Mari Mese Tunye Nyugo Chini Chunze Raji Tunye Taji Saji Dazi Yundi Lunzo Yase Tuwe Ku Chuda Chuda Chuni Kente Talu Mese Yangla Tu Vajana Di Omo Ara Vajana Arabazana de Omo Arabazana de 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 Lodzhi bobe nawa tse do tse Jujhi me do tama tira lin shi nyin de gyan gham di Sangye shin do me de bwa ye Jogun nam da shin na jo Tamba ke naman ge chugu kala kenze tinte ne Chedara Tsambe Duje Zema La Savje Chuje Abdo Su Mendala Gana Yadaya Me Tsoje Chonamala Chanchu Bado Tane Gyansu Che Tage Chushe Jebe Sonamange Drola Sanje Drobara Sho Chöda Zoye Chona La Chanchu Bado Tane Gyabzu Tage Chöshe Gebe Sonam Ge Dola Benje San Dobara Echo Zoye Chona La Chanchu Bado Tane Gyabzu Tage Chöshe Gebe Sonam Ge Dola Dobara Echo Ladan lame medami anje ombo dan jajin la so chuje jola chawa cheba naman sanje somba rabdo sheshen tewe gyujo ba deda sheje tambe chunye shenen de sheshe namo laye gyadan ludan nyojin ge rubon dadan minye ge namdan jowa gwenye chanam che zamba tamche ge do tage chudun do Good morning.
Good morning.
Today, I think we have to make a bit of changes in our routine. So instead of having the sharing session in the beginning, we will do that after the end of the session, if there is time, because we need to finish all that. So if we have the session before, I don't know whether we will be able to finish or not. So first I wanted to clarify this point, because there have been questions on this equanimity, and Anthony raised that question, and then Chuck also had this question. So this equanimity, I think it's one word which is used in different settings or for different meanings. So Tibetan word is tangnyom, tangnyom. So tangnyom, there are different meanings for tangnyom. Tangnyom can mean chowa tangnyom, that is feeling. So you don't feel that your practice arrived at a certain stage where you don't feel these gross sensations, gross feelings. So like when you attain what is called Samdhin Shiva, the fourth stage of concentrated meditation, where you don't have this gross experience of feelings. So you don't feel the grosser level of pleasant experience as well as pain and all that, unpleasant experiences. So your feeling is kind of a neutral. So they also use the term tangnyom. So sometimes the translation use equanimity. So it doesn't mean that you are in that is in relation to feelings. And then when we talk about developing equanimity as a foundation to cultivate compassion, that's different. That's here to reduce this discriminatory attitude. You know, when we see a group of people whom we label as friends or families, we have this attachment towards their people. And there is, behind that, there is a reason. We come up with our own reason why we have this attachment, because they are my friends, they helped me, they did this and that. And then to a certain group of people, let's say those whom you have difficulty with, then we have another set of emotions, aversion, I don't know, this repulsiveness or whatever. So these also are based on this bias, I mean, a kind of a unfounded basis, because we label them as enemies. But remember, we discussed that enemy and friends, there is nothing absolute in there. It can change, it fluctuates. A day's friend can become a night's enemy. Evening's enemy can be your best friend in the morning. So because we base our this label and attitude on that reasoning, so there it is a bit shaky. And then when we see those people who is not, you know, whom we label as strangers, so we have this indifference attitude. So when we talk about equanimity in developing compassion, we should not have this biased attitude towards towards sentient beings. We should not have these different categories. So in order to help that, we have to view them as sentient beings are equal from their side. Whether it's enemy, whether it's friends, whether it's stranger, from their own side, just like us, they also wish to experience happiness. They want happiness. They want to avoid a tiniest pain and suffering. So from their own side, it's same. There's no reason to discriminate from our side, because we have committed, we have pledged to help all sentient beings. Our bodhicitta and compassion is for all sentient beings. So there is no reason from our own side to discriminate. So this is mainly to eliminate that category, because we base that category on our own reason
which does not really stand the logic. So that's I wanted to clarify before we start to the our actual class. Where were we? Fourth. So I found another picture. Look at this picture. One is His Holiness, one is Sajja Tenzin Rinpoche. This is what we mean by humble. This is what we mean by humility. His Holiness is like that, you know. Doesn't need to bow to anyone. But look at this. When you see that, it's so touching and so inspiring. Look at each other. They're all head of this, but still they are bowing so low to each other. That's what we meant by this wheat. When you have qualities, when you have the actual essence there, it naturally comes down, bends. So this is where we are. What is the Tibetan word? Tibetan line. Rangshin yin be sim jin nang. Tidu tabu nyon tong zhe. Rangshin te dang te ban shin. Nye bar ka ve jin zin shows. Whenever I see ill-natured people or overwhelmed by heavy misdeeds or suffering, I will cherish them as something rare, as though I'd found a priceless treasure. Can we do that?
No.
Yeah, so this, we have to think from this Buddhist. This is all about Bodhisattva's practice. So when we generate bodhicitta, our commitment is to benefit all sentient beings. We are not excluding anybody. We are committed to serve and help each and every sentient beings. But then what happens when you encounter this kind of people who are naturally, you know, ill-natured, very unpleasant, obnoxious? Yeah, just seeing that person, it kind of, you know, this, what do you call it, the repulsive person. You don't want to do anything with that. But if we ignore those people, then what happens? We are not doing the practice. So these are to, mainly these eight verses of mind training is actually what to do when we encounter these kind of challenges. So here we have this generated, this, you know, very noble kind of a intention to benefit all sentient beings. And then when we actually go about doing it, and then we encounter this kind of people. So that's what should we do. So that's what Langri Thampa is saying. So when we have this kind of ill-natured people, instead of neglecting them, we should even more generate compassion towards them. Because those people, even though, yeah, when we look at them, they seemed maybe happy, but most of those people, yeah, they don't look happy. They really suffer. And we can tell from their behavior, their action, their nature, who wants to be friend with them? Who wants to associate with them? So these kind of people, they really suffer, how should I put it? They experience so much mental pain and suffering. They want to, that person is just like us, wanting to have more friends, wanting to be happy, wanting to be praised by others, wanting to be liked by others. But because of the way they behave, nobody wants to do that. Nobody wants to give that. Nobody likes the person. So in that, when you look from that perspective, from that view, we should be feeling more compassionate towards especially those people who lack that kind of quality to achieve their aspirations, their desire or their wish. So here that's what he's saying, that you know, whenever I see ill-natured people, we should cherish them. And then overwhelmed by heavy misdeeds or suffering. So this teaching is one time known as the practice. This practice is one time known as the practice of lepers, those people with leprosy. Because there are what we call group of people who are socially marginalized, like people who are suffering from AIDS, who have AIDS, nobody wants to associate with you. And then lepers. Nowadays, I don't know, it is curable, is it?
No.
No, still not curable. And then it is curable? And then it is contagious, isn't it?
Yes, but
yeah. No, it's a. So because of that, we don't want to associate with them. And this, the practice, Chekawa, who made this available for wider audience, yeah? So, Chekawa. So, he practiced this himself, and then he brought this to lepers and let them practice this. And there were stories where those lepers who really practiced that, they got healed. And because of that, more and more lepers practiced this. And then it was known as the practice of lepers. So our natural habit or tendency is when we see this kind of people, we kind of go away. We want to avoid these people, especially when we see in the street homeless people, you know, dress really badly and then dirty and smelly and all this. We run away from them. We don't want to do anything. So here is saying that you have to view it as a priceless treasure. Imagine if a homeless people, a beggar, stumble onto a chest of treasure. How would that person would feel? There's a lot of joy, happiness. The way a beggar feels, you know, that kind of elation or joy finding a treasure, we should practice. We should see all these people. Let's try our practice on Trump. That would be the starting point. Yeah. So I think it is because at the moment we are just looking from our own perspective. We are not really getting into their shoe or that person's shoe. When we really think of that from that person's view, then yeah, instead of animosity and aversion and anger, I think there is chance that we feel some kind of a, if not compassion, some kind of a pity that, you know, how that person is suffering. So that's one way to go about it. So that's the meaning here. But this is not easy. Not easy. And then the verse 5. The purpose of Rangjin Yenbe Simjin, Tigdu Tabu Nundus, Rangjin Ted and Tabashi, never carry a chin in show. Tala Shenji Tado Ye. So whenever someone out of envy does wrong by attacking or belittling me, I will take defeat upon myself and give the victory to others. this seems out of this realm, isn't it? So here, whenever someone out of envy, so in Tibetan we said, Tala shenje chatoge, out of jealousy, out of envy. Shigur lasu miribe. Shigur she means scolding. Basically, you know, they will in front of you criticize and in front of you say things and scold you. And it may be that, you know, it is baseless, you unjustly. You haven't done anything, but, you know, person scolds you. So that happens quite often at workplace, isn't it? Sometimes when you have a difficult boss always picking on you and you wonder, you know, why this is happening. So anyway, so this is what it's saying is attacking you or belittling you or just picking on you without any of your own faults of your own. And she kur means talking behind, kind of spreading rumor about you, saying all the nasty things about you, which actually you didn't do anything. I said, oh, you know, he did this and he did this, she did this, she did that. So when this happens, what should we do? Of course, our natural tendency or response is to attack the person, to go and confront the person. But here saying that we should not do that. Instead, offer the defeat. Remember the story about Lung Ritambo himself? Yeah. A woman brought a child and said that this is your child. And without uttering even one word, he accepted the child and raised the child. And then later, the lady apologized. Later, a few years later, the lady came back and apologized, explained, and I want my baby back. Here, okay. You have your baby back. So that's what it means. And then there was a story that happened in Bhutan. So there was this geshe who was doing retreat for most of his lifetime. He was from Ganden Monastery. One time he was known as the geshe with the clairvoyance. So in Bhutan, people are really devoted. So when they heard that there's this geshe doing retreat there, and especially when they heard about the part that, you know, oh, he has clairvoyance. So people started queuing up. He is really way up in jungle. But people, that didn't stop people from going to see him. So there's always a queue of people. But of course, it's like he will allow this audience after, I think it's 12. From 12 starts, because that's when after he comes out of his meditation. And then he prepares meal or whatever it is. So if you're able to arrive that time, then you will get to see him. Otherwise, you won't. But many people go with their all kinds of problems, sicknesses, but there were many stories where people get cured and all that. And then Bhutan people being, you know, very, what do you call it, with strong faith, they make a lot of offerings. And Geshe La has no use for that. So Geshe La offers that all that money and whatever it is to his own monastery. And I was told that every two months or 3 months, a monk will come to collect the money from south. But that word got around, that people can see that people are really offering, and there's a really long queue every day. And the beggar, the thieves or robbers, they got the idea, oh, he lives alone here, and, you know, there's always a long queue offering money to him. We better try our luck. So one night, they came, two robbers came. And then, of course, they enter his hut. And Geshe La said that, if you are here for money, please take the money. No point killing me. It won't serve you any purpose. I will go out. You take all the money. So they went in and searched whatever, wherever the Geshe-la put the money, and then they left. And then Geshe-la went in, and he checked and found that there was one spot they didn't see. So he shouted after them, "Hey, come back, you didn't, you there's some, you left one bundle there." And he gave it to them, and since then, they never came back. So this is a practice. This is what we're supposed to do. Because he did that, they didn't dare to come back. I think they must have felt, you know, something extraordinary or whatever it is. So in that story, it shows that this is what it means by offering victory to others. Instead of, you know, fighting and all this. Normally we wouldn't call after them to say that, you know, you haven't taken everything. There's some more. So that's the story. So of course, we will discuss later how to manage this. So now the question is, so when we say that, you know, we have to offer a victory to others and accept defeat, does it mean that we become a doormat for others? We let everybody, you know, treat us badly and take advantage of us? That is the question. So whatever every people say, you know, people bully you, whatever it is, shall we just, you know, take it on? I say we have to take action. But there is a stanza, I don't know which text. 투베 뇨모 다르세냐 뇨모 당데 강사 means. So Buddha views affliction as the arch enemy, but not the person. So even though when we were treated badly or unjustly by another person, so here it is saying that we should not get angry at the person, but we should get, if we want to get angry at his afflictions, which is the driver. So, have compassion for the person, but we should not condone his action. So that's what His Holiness always say. Yes, you can stand up, but make sure that whatever you are doing is not out of anger. And anger is when sometimes, you know, you do it because of this, your ego. Or if I don't fight, people will view me as a coward person. People will say that, oh, he didn't stand up to that person. Then, of course, there's another intention there. But if we really have this compassion, poor fellow, you know, he doesn't realize what he is doing. He is driven by this affliction, this anger. And then, yeah, if you kind of go and talk to the person, maybe that is. But the importance here is not to get angry at the person. That's why His Holiness says that in the practice of tolerance, one's enemy is the best teacher. So that person, whoever is giving you or unjustly accusing you, giving you all that problem, if you are able to see that person as your teacher, then, yeah, you will be able to tolerate that. And actually, that is the only person who provides us the opportunity to practice patience. Our friends hardly irritate us. So there's no way we can develop patience through our friends. But whereas through force, we can develop patience. And then, what happens when, you know, we have, what is the Tibetan one now? Kangla dhagi pen dhawe rewachawa kangshi ki shindu meri nyo chenang shenyin tambara dhawa shows. So we can understand why other people, you know, treat us badly, harm us. But then there are incidences where your best friends betray you. The people whom you have really helped, you have done so much, they also betray you. They also create harms. So in such situation, what should we do? What bodhisattvas should do? Then it says that even when someone I have helped or in whom I have placed great hopes mistreats me very unjustly, I will view that person as a true spiritual teacher. So instead of seeing that person as our enemy, we should view that person as our spiritual teacher. It is, in that sense, it is our spiritual teacher. I mean, if we practice patience. If not, we will then create more negative actions. We will get angry, we will say something else, and then yeah, it gets worse. And then it destroys our virtue. So now, so there are three stanzas. So how do we practice? So this one we should bring from the Shantidevas, the patience chapter. That will help. We have already covered this during the patience chapter. But I thought to kind of go through it again. So in Shantideva's text, it is very detailed, and it examines each and every kind of from each and every angle. So the first one is the object. On analysis of whether the object has self-control. So first of all, when we encounter this kind of people, our usual reaction is to get angry. But then we have to caution ourselves. Is it really worth doing? So Shantideva says that chila bhabyan thagi ni gawe yi ni tumi ja miga che jang de me tu kewa tani nyamar jurs kedi cho su yonani tela miga chishi yos. So Shantideva offers this explanation. Now what happens is when we get upset by another person's action, that will destroy our peace of mind. And then that will destroy our virtue. So he says that chila bhavya thagine, in whatever instances, I will not destroy my this joy and peace of mind. Because he says that even if you get upset with that person, that will not solve the problem. But instead, it will destroy your merit. So the reason is that why we should not destroy our peace of mind. Why should we not respond negatively towards this kind of situation? It says that kedichu su yonani telamiga chishiyu, kedichu su menani telamiga chejipen. So that's a very famous line. If it can be remedied, why worry? If it cannot be remedied, what is the point of worrying about it? So this, I find it very good, very effective. When I lost my father, I was very close with my father. So that really helped me. Because normally, yeah, we will indulge, what do you call it? We will feel sad and we will, ruminate about, you know, our past with the father, whatever that is. Then we feel sad and worry. But then, you know, does really, you know, worrying and feeling sad helps the situation. My feeling set won't bring back my father. If it can, Daniel, why not, you know, hire people to come in, you know, please, you know, some traditional practice, they have professional mourners when the body is being brought to the cremation site. They have these professional mourners. They will cry and wail and all this. If it can help, why not? We can hire those people. But it does not. It does not bring the person back. So, if there is something that we can do to bring back, we should do that. If not, no point doing that. So this is what it's saying. When person causes you harm, the harm is already, done. So if somebody punch you, you have already experienced the pain. So by getting angry, the pain would not go. Pain is already you have experienced. So it won't change what happened. But it will cause more pain if you continue getting upset over it. So that's what Shantideva is saying. So now this is where Shantideva is teaching us to analyze. So when person causes you harm, or say some nasty things, whatever it is, does the person has the control over the situation? Since the person doesn't have self-control, it says anger is unjustified. Why the person is doing this is he doesn't want to, you know, want to get angry. Yeah, this reminded me of a story. My teacher, own teacher, who is by nature very soft and peaceful. But Rinpoche has these two young students. So every morning they will come and give their memorization text. So being young monk, you know, sometimes they don't memorize, they don't do their homework. So Rinpoche has to pretend that he is angry. And one time I was there because they went first and I was the next in line to give my memorization text. And then these two boys sat in there and then, yeah, they were struggling. They didn't memorize the day before. So Rinpoche was trying to show that Rinpoche is very angry. And then Rinpoche, seeing the boys, reaction, in which it bursts into laughter. So we say, I cannot do that. So, yeah. Yeah, why did I say that? What did it come from? So anyway, yeah, whether it is self-control or whether a person has self-control or not. So the angry person hurls some hurtful names and all this because the person has no control. He is controlled, he or she is controlled by his anger. If person has control, the person wouldn't do, because that person is also like us, wanting to be happy. And we know from our own experience that when we get angry, we don't have that peaceful state of mind. The minute anger arises, you feel it. It really destroyed your peace of mind. So if a person has control over these emotions, then a thinking person wouldn't do it. So this suggests that person has no control. He or she is being, propelled by or compelled by anger. So that is why it says that our anger is not justified, unjustified. And then it says whether it is advantageous or inherency. Whether the anger is, you know, external, just suddenly, you know, is is caused by external things or by chance, or it is inherently there. It is the person's nature. So if it is person's nature, then more so we shouldn't get angry. It is unjustified. Because remember the analogy, the example? The fire. The nature of fire is to burn. So we do not complain when fire burns, because we know that that is the nature of fire. So likewise, if the anger is the person's nature, then we cannot blame them. Our anger is unjustified. But if it is advantageous, then more so it is caused by cause and conditions. So that person has no real control over it. And then this is the favorite, whether the harm is direct or indirect, anger is unjustified. Remember that stick, analogy of the stick. So when somebody hits you with a stick, who do we get angry at? Do we get angry at the stick or the wielder? So if you are getting angry at something that caused direct harm, then you should be getting angry at the stick, not at the person, because the actual pain is caused by the stick. So that is the direct harm doer. So we should get angry at the stick, but we don't get angry at the stick. But then we can say, the stick by itself wouldn't cause harm. You need somebody else to wield that and then hit at you. So if your reason is causing indirect harm, then he says that you shouldn't also get angry at the person, because he is also propelled by his anger. If your reason is the indirect harm causer, then it should be the anger that you should be angry at. And then finally, we examine, we analyze what is the cause of that harm the person did to us. So when we really examine that, what is the cause? First of all, harm does not come about without cause and condition. And what is the cause of condition? Cause and conditions. The main cause is all one of the negative, these 10 non-virtuous actions. Remember when we discussed about the consequences of 10 non-virtuous actions, the killing, the consequences of killing, the resultant of killing is to experience harm in our next life. So when we analyze and examine the cause of harm, it is our own karma. We created that karma in the past. No way we would experience harm without us creating the cause and conditions. So if that is the case, why are you angry at the person for causing that harm? Because you are actually the cause. It is not the other person. Other person could be just a condition, not the real cause. Then finally, analyzing one's commitment. So here we are talking about bodhicitta. We all call ourselves Mahayana practitioners. So Mahayana practitioners and those who follow the Pali tradition, the difference is because the distinguishing difference is this bodhicitta. One who has generated bodhicitta becomes Mahayana practitioner. Whereas those who aspire for self-liberation are those who follow the Pali tradition, or what we call Theravada tradition. So if we claim ourselves to be Mahayana practitioner, so we should be practicing bodhicitta. We should be cultivating bodhicitta. And bodhicitta, when we cultivate bodhicitta, we commit to helping all sentient beings. Then why are we engaging in anger and all that? And secondly, it is incongruent to what we aspire and what we are actually doing. There is this gap. By getting angry, we are creating the causes to lower rebirth. But we want to achieve good rebirth. And then we want to achieve nirvana, Buddhahood and all that. So creating negative actions won't lead us to our goals, our desired goals. So there is engaging in anger is incongruent to our desired goal, our aspiration, what we aspire to achieve. So from that point of view, we should not. So this all can be summarized by this line. Never wrestle with a pig. He gets dirty, you get dirty, and he likes it. So don't fuel your anger. Don't give fuel to your anger. It will lead to more. And anger likes it. All these affliction emotions, the more we give attention to, the more we accommodate it, they become stronger and stronger, and it become our, what you call, the dominant nature. But when we kind of put a stop to it, then slowly, slowly, yeah, it will,
dissipate.
we will have less.
It will weaken.
Yeah, it will be weakened, and we will experience less and less of these negative emotions or negative or afflictive emotions. So, this is how we are supposed to do. There is no other easy way. We can recite the prayers. In the morning, we do this recitation, and then it will be helpful if we are able to really go through this line. You can bring to your mind, a person whom you have difficulty with. And then try to use this analysis that Shantideva suggested. And I think the first time, second time, maybe it is difficult. But if you are persistent with this, maybe we will be able to reduce our animosity or hatred toward that person. And then in brief, directly or indirectly, I will offer health and happiness to all my mothers and secretly take upon myself all their hurt and suffering. So this is the teaching on the practice of Tonglen. So basically saying that whatever all this is, in brief, in short, I will offer my health and happiness to all my mothers, all my mothers, all my sentient beings, and then secretly take upon myself all their hurt and suffering. Samaya thala lembarsho. There is this word secretly. So there is a reason for that. So I think there are two reasons. The first reason, people have different mental capacities. People have different mental dispositions. So because of that, we have these two yanas in the first place. We have two vehicles, Mahayana and then Theravada or Hinayana. So some people are very comfortable with working towards self-liberation. They cannot really think about, you know, helping others. So tekpa, Tibetan word is tekpa. We call it yana or vehicle. Tekpa means to able to carry. Let's say if somebody is carrying a load, it is like, I can carry that much weight, that much load. So that's why we have two different yanas. So some can carry a lot. Those we call it Mahayana, who can not only aspire for their liberation, but also want to liberate all sentient beings. So they are the ones who can carry more loads. Whereas the Theravada practitioners, or Theravada, yeah, so they are only concerned about their self-liberation. So in that mental capacity, so we have two yanas. So that's why these Mahayana practices are not for everybody, because of our inclinations, the different inclinations. That's one reason. Secondly, this practice, I think we discussed before, until Chekhova, these practices are taught to our selected disciples. There was no documented teachings, no written teachings. It's all through oral transmissions. Because imagine like taking upon other sufferings. That is not something people can do. Not everybody can handle. So that's why the Lama normally kind of examine the disciples, and then when they are comfortable that the disciple is the vessel to receive these teachings, only then they teach it orally. So that is why it says somewhere, that's one reason. Another reason is when you engage in these practices, you have to keep these practices to yourself, not to boast. So I do this, I am Mahayana, you know, I practice this. That inflates one's ego, and then that becomes obstacles to our practice. And that's the next line. That becomes then, it falls under this the eight worldly concerns. Then it is stained by these concerns. So now here, the essence of this line is to practice Tonglen. So Tonglen practice, I think most of you are familiar. So we talked about the practice of loving compassion. We talked about the practice of compassion. So Tonglen is an emphasis on these two practices. Tonglen, there are two syllables. Tong, to give. Len, to take. Tonglen. So when we engage in giving, it is the practice of loving. What is that one? Loving, not loving compassion. What is that one? We have love, we have compassion. So you're engaging in the practice of loving affection. Yeah, loving affection meditation, where you give the actually love and compassion. The difference is that love is the wish for all the other sentient beings to have all the happiness and its causes. Whereas compassion is the wish for others to be free from all the sufferings and to free from all the causes of suffering. So there's this distinction. So when we engage in giving, we are practicing in loving affection, practice of loving affection. Somehow it's this
loving kindness.
Loving kindness. Yes, thank you. Yeah, loving kindness. Loving kindness. That's when we give or send our joy, happiness, and all the causes, all the merits, all the qualities of ours to others. But you cannot do that. I mean, no point doing that unless the other person is free of all sufferings and its causes. So that's why, even though when we say Tong Len, Tong, giving as the first, giving comes first, but we should, in actual practice, we should take upon us first. The logic is that if you don't remove or eliminate their suffering, then no matter whatever you give to them, they will be still in the suffering. So that's why, even though in texts and all these teachings appears as Tong Len, giving and taking, but in actual practice, we do the reverse. We start with the taking, and then we end with the giving. So how do we do that? Oh, sorry, this is supposed to come here. The practice of giving and taking. So first, we need to reflect on the sufferings of sentient beings. So that, if you want to have a real sense of what others are going through, first we need to contemplate on our own suffering. Once you have real sense of, you know, kind of suffering, suffering, when we talk about suffering, it is not the suffering of suffering, which, you know, we the physical pain and all this, but we have more pervasive kind of suffering. We have the suffering of change, suffering of pervasive suffering and all that. So when you contemplate on that, and when you have some idea, some sense of suffering, then you kind of focus that on other sentient beings. You can, for beginners, I think it is easier to reflect on the pains that people are suffering, the grosser level of pains, those who are, you know, fighting their lives in hospitals, having all kinds of pain and all that difficulty, those who are in cold weathers, homeless people. You can imagine how much pain and suffering they are going through when it is weather is so cold and all that. So for the beginners, I think you can start with that, and then you can develop or progress to the real suffering. So what we are at the moment doing is the suffering of suffering, but then later you can progress to contemplate on the suffering of change, pervasive suffering and all that. And once you have this, once you generated this feeling of compassion for others through contemplating on the sufferings they are undergoing, and then you send out, you take upon that suffering. So there is a visualization involved. So this is supposed to be the, in text it says black light, but I put, in some texts it says smokes, but I put it kind of a cloud thing, so it's easier to visualize. So you visualize others' pain. You can start with your friends and families first. Those who are suffering, let's say you have a friend who is in the hospital suffering, then you can start with that person and imagine what kind of suffering they are going through. And then visualize that suffering in the form of black light or a smoke or a black cloud. Then you imagine, visualize that, you know, coming, you're taking that on upon you in the form of this a black light or black cloud or black smoke, and then entering you. So sometimes it is quite scary to do that. So what helps is if you can imagine that dissolving or entering into your this self-cherishing mind. That is very helpful because we need to destroy the self-cherishing mind. So imagine that taking that other suffering and then it dissolving into or entering into this self-cherishing thought. That's the practice of taking upon other suffering. So you can start with your friends and relatives, families, and then you can extend that beyond that circle. Then when it comes to giving, so you send out your happiness, your joy, the causes for all joy and happiness, and then merits, your qualities in the form of white light. And then you imagine that kind of entering into that other person. And then imagine that that person receives and fills with that joy and happiness. So that is a very general way of doing. But if you want to do an elaborate one, then you can visualize, you can first contemplate, you can go by realm by realm. So like the lower realms, three realms, we have this, the hell realms. You contemplate on the sufferings, like hot hell. They are being burned there. They desire for something cool and cold. So you imagine all that heat and suffering taking upon that heat and suffering onto you. And then when you send out that, you can imagine your this white ray, when it reaches the hell beings, it transforms into kind of a cool shower or something that can give them, that can provide that cool that they are desiring for. And then also if you want to do more elaborate way is to imagine that then, you know, all their sufferings are eliminated, and then they get all the clothes, whatever they want, and then they also receive teachings, and then they achieve enlightenment. So these are different stages. But for the beginners, yeah, we can just focus on whatever we can easily visualize. Especially there are so many sick people in the hospitals. So you can send out your love, your joy to those people and then bring upon, take upon others' pain and suffering. Okay. So far, we have discussed seven verses. So when you go through all this and if you are able to practice according to these teachings, it is so wonderful. But then, let's say even if you are able to do all that, but then your intention, motivation is stained by these practices, or what do you call these concerns or these intentions, then yeah, all that is kind of a waste. You practice, but that does not really become a Dharma practice. it becomes our worldly or mundane practice. So here it is. That's why Langri Thampa is cautioning us to be very careful. It is so wonderful that, you know, you are doing all this, but then make sure that all that practices are not contaminated by these mundane or worldly concerns. That people eat curry and tingle into the goddy. Teda gunja choje ji tobe teme ma le bes ani chugun jumar shebe lu shime sheme chwa le de shows. So I will learn to keep all these practices untainted by thoughts of the eight worldly concerns. May I recognize all... So until this is what we call, there are two types of bodhicitta, the cultivation of conventional bodhicitta and then cultivation of ultimate bodhicitta. So until here, the first two lines is all about conventional bodhicitta, and then goes on to talk about the ultimate bodhicitta. May I recognize all things like illusion-like and without attachment gain freedom. So what are the eight? Let's see, what are the eight worldly concerns? Let's see whether we can remember. Anybody want to volunteer?
Well, I'll start. Gain and loss.
Good.
Somebody else, come on.
Gain and loss. Fame versus insignificance. Praise versus blame.
Yes.
Blame.
Fame.
Happiness versus suffering.
Yeah,
it is in front. Yeah. Can you try to remember? Yeah. So, when we really, 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 you know, honestly scrutinize our practices, there is danger of falling under one of these. So we are really habituated with these concerns. Even coming here, how many dress did you try? Oh, will this look nice on me? Or how about if I go with this, go in this, or I must shower, I must put on makeup, all this. These are all one of these concerns. Because you want to be presentable, look presentable. And what happens if you don't look presentable? Because people will talk, people will criticize me. People will talk badly about me. If I go in a nice dress, all this, people will praise me, people will like me. So we are all the time concerned with this. Even our practices. Many, there are many Buddhists, so-called practitioners. They go to temple, offer this incense, and then what prayers do they make? May I strike a lottery. Yeah, it's all about that. May I become popular. May I become famous. All this. And even we can tell from our own experience. When we meet with a person, how do we present ourselves? I am so and so, and then you talk about yourself. Is to promote yourself because you want to look, I don't know, what is the word?
Significant.
Look significant, yeah, in another person's eyes. And some people, when you talk about, they will talk, you know, as if they are such a scholars and all that. And I noticed that when I went to this Mind and Life conference, it was so stuck, and I caught myself doing that. Over there, all, of course, everybody are into research. So when we meet at the... They purposely give you this time during the meal and all this to share your ideas and all this. But it come across like everybody is promoting oneself. Oh, you know, I'm this and this, I do this and this. Oh, my research is, I'm now at the moment doing this and this. And I started to follow that, and then I kind of caught myself. It is really promoting. But then if you don't say that, it's like there's nothing really to talk. So that's what we do all the time. And I wanted people to know that I am doing this research on compassion. So you have to promote that. But deep down, yeah, if I examine my motivation, it is actually mostly worldly concern. If my motivation is that, oh, you know, if my this idea gets through and if I get support, if others show interest, then, you know, I will able to come up with this method and then that will benefit so many people in long term. If that was the real motivation, that's worth doing it. But I think it's not there. It is mainly I wanted people to acknowledge my this new theory or whatever you call. So that's why we have to be very careful. And it is very common in Tibetan community to sponsor big puja at monasteries. So they will they have to sponsor the whole day meal and then make offerings. So not all, but some people, there is this worldly concern, or if I offer this much money, people will talk, you know, he has offered 500 rupees to each monks. Or if I sponsor this, people will say, wow, he is so generous. Every special event the family would sponsor. That kind of. So even though there is a virtue in that, but it is questionable whether it becomes a dharma, real dharma. So, I think a few years ago, the Lhoka, Tibetan, we have these different communities. So they wanted to offer long life puja to His Holiness. So they came to me, of course, to ask for donation. So at that, of course, they didn't come for donation, they come for advice. So I told them that you really need to check your motivation. Why are you doing this? Are you doing because all the other, you know, these groups have done it and you feel that, oh, we also have to do. Otherwise, you know, we will be seen white crow, like a white crow, or I don't know. Yeah, so there is a lot of these, what do you call, habits or practice that it is not really dharma motivation. It is just that, you know, oh, we will look nice. If we organize this one, oh, it will be, you know, we will be praised. Our association, our, group will be recognized. That kind of intention. All these are worldly concerns. So if you do any practice with this kind of, what I call this is, I like to use the word preoccupation. So your main focus is to, we get so delighted and elated when we achieve some gain, and then we experience some loss, then we will be so saddened and all that. If that becomes the main preoccupation of your endeavors, then, yeah, it is at worldly concern. And most dangerous is praise and blame, and fame, and also insignificance. We are very prone to this fame and insignificance. We don't want to appear insignificant. We want to be seen as a, you know, famous and somebody important. So that's why we do all kinds of things. And sometimes in the process, we lie. Even though we don't know, we will say, I know this, I know that, I read that, oh, I attended this. So, so dangerous. And then fame, what people do for fame. Then to keep up that, you know, the celebrities, they cannot take it. They have to be in the limelight all the time. Because if they are not in that limelight, they feel that they become like insignificant. So in order to be in the limelight all the time, they do all kinds of things. And then they get addicted. They have to use all kinds of things. So what Lungri Thamba is saying, that all this practice is so good, you know, if you are doing this, but make sure that it is not tainted by these worldly concerns. Whatever we are doing should be motivated by bodhicitta, by wish, this genuine wish to help others, genuine wish to help, genuine wish to achieve enlightenment in order to benefit other sentient beings. So that's the outwardly concerns. And then the second, this one, hey, where is it now? May I recognize all things like illusion, yeah, illusions, and without attachment gain freedom. So this is about emptiness, having this wisdom, whatever we do in our practice, to have this insight inseparable in our practices. Whatever we do, we realize that things are like illusions. So what happens is when we do empty meditation, emptiness meditation, we normally have the actual session of meditation where the person really single-pointedly meditate on emptiness. And then what is called the post-session. So the person, when person comes out of the session, so that is what is called the post-session. So during that actual session, no way you will have this appearance of intrinsic nature of things. You are fully absorbed in the meditation of emptiness. But when you come out of that, when you started to see the conventional things, it all that things will appear to you as having independent identity. But then, because of your realization into the insight, you will not kind of apprehend that. You will look it, you will view it as illusion-like, like the reflection in the mirror. When we look in the mirror, we see image there, we see ourselves in there. Even though it appears as that is you, that is us, but we say that is just a reflection. So we are able to have this, what do you call this? This, what appear is not what it is in, what is real. So this is what it is saying. Since there is time, I think we should do a short exercise. You pair with a partner, you choose one person, and then you ask this question. So each one take turns, maybe 1 minute or 2 minutes, maybe 2 minutes. Who are you? The other person will say, I'm so and so. Then, or you can say, who are you? I'm this and this. Who are you? So you keep asking the question, the other person keep answering for 2 minutes, and then you switch. Then the other person asks the same question, who are you? And you answer. And then say, who are you? You answer. You cannot repeat the same answer. You have to come up with another answer.
The question will be the same.
Question is same all the time. Who are you? I'm Ken. Who are you? I'm someone, so whatever you want to say. Okay, let's do it. You pick a partner. Wait, huh? I'm going to. I will ring a bell. Then you can start. Are you ready? Ready now? Okay, let's go.
I'm a person who shows up every Sunday for the church. I'm a for Duto.
Oh, that's okay. I'm just trying to figure out
where I'm a person who's answering questions.
Switch. You don't have to count the question, yeah. You just ask.
No, I think it's kind of interesting. Like, you could actually.
Okay, go ahead. Now the other one. You switch. Other person. Oh, wow, so fast. Okay, begin the next one. Go.
That was too quick.
Huh? No, it's not finished. So now that you, next person, yeah.
Who are you?
All my best meditation study is evening.
Okay, are we ready to share? What do you think? What do you get from this? The question is, who are you? The other person is supposed to reply something. And then you keep asking, who are you? Who are you? Who are you? Who are you? So, what do you get from this?
There's a bunch of labels. There's a bunch of labels that we apply to ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
But when you start digging into them, that's all they are. You don't. Mm-hmm. Who are you? Well, you give another label. Well, so where's me? And you give another label. Well, where's me? Mm. Who's this person? Who is Brian? Mm. There's another label. You know, another way that Brian identifies himself.
Mm.
It's a label. There's another label, and I can identify Brian by those labels. I don't see a Brian.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Anyone?
Self-reference, there seems to be a lot of self-reference reference to phenomena and reference to self, person and self.
Mm-hmm.
But for those who have some training, they've been working on negating that and shedding that. So all you have is these these words that basically for being, you know, just your being.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Anybody?
Composed. I am. What you said, I represent so many things, but referencing to I, but I'm not just one.
You are a collection.
Collection, yeah, collection of many quality or anything you are.
Okay, thank you.
I was just going to say that all the things I was listing were really roles that I play, and that I don't identify that strongly with, like saying I'm an accountant. It's something I do conventionally, but I don't feel that strongly about it, so it was a lot of roles.
Any more? Anyone? Yes, go ahead.
When I hear, and you know, like when I said, who are you? I, all are I this, you know?
Mm.
And then at the end realize that I don't think so, you know, like that. That there's a, I'm Sonam, you know, the Sonam, where's Sonam? The feet is Sonam or hand is Sonam? there's, you know, you can't. There's nothing empty. I think that's to be realized.
Okay, thank you. I think you all got the gist of it.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, this is, I don't know, this, I thought that when I went to this conference, so they use this. Of course, they are not trying to get insight into emptiness, but I thought that we can use this to have this insight. So I think you are right. So we give all kinds of labels. So we are just a bunch of labels. So when it comes to whether there is real I or not, there is none from the middle parts approach. So it is just, as somebody said, collection of parts.
We also a reflection of the societies and the groups. That we've been part of, because they interacted with us and they formed a certain entity. So we're, you know, that's also part of what's...
Yeah, also interdependence.
Yes.
You know, we come about because of, you know, depending on all these parts. Yeah. Yeah, so that's the gist of it. So that's why here it is, may I recognize all things like illusions. So when we practice, so here some terms they use, the three spheres. So when you practice yourself, you view yourself as illusion-like, whatever the object of your compassion or practice, view that as a illusion-like, and also your actual action, also view that as illusion-like. So that's the main, I think, the main teaching here. Remember, we have talked about this in Lamrim. It is very clear that whatever we do, there are some exceptions that due to the power of three jewels, our action may become Dharma practice or may become a cause to achieve enlightenment. Other than that, if it is not complemented by this wisdom realizing emptiness, then it says that whatever we do, it is just creating another set of causes and conditions to bring us back to samsara. But if we have this kind of insight, of this kind of wisdom all the time, when we are mindful of this, that the things not existing from its own, and if you are able to view that, you know, these are illusion-like, then our practice becomes the real cause and conditions to causes to achieve enlightenment. So that's the end of this teaching. And since there is still 15 minutes, mm-hmm. as promised, I will give the floor to share your experiences, how you integrated the teachings in your life. Yes, please, go ahead. Anybody
can
want
I,
to?
Can I bring up something which is touchy subject among some Western Buddhists, and that's the idea of greater and lesser vehicle. Mahayana versus
Hinayana.
Versus Theravada.
Mm.
The idea that one makes you great, one is greater than the other.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a difficult concept. And I know that in the context of Mahayana practice, you have to look at all of them as part, both as part of practice.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to look at anything less than Mahayana as not being a complete practice. But nonetheless, my own experience from interactions and also from reading books and so on by people who are Theravada practitioners is they work very hard at developing loving kindness and compassion. So in the context of doing Tonglen based on proclivities and particular inclinations, it becomes kind of I have to sort of redefine it in a way, at least for myself. I know other people feel in this room feel the same way, in such a way that it doesn't lessen people who do not follow Hinayana traditions.
Mm.
So, do you have thoughts about that? Have you, you know, your interactions with people?
Yeah, if I understand your question correctly, yeah. So I think in Lamrim teaching and all Lojong teaching, it is very clearly mentioned that we should not be little. We should not kind of, you know, look down on Mahayana or the Theravada practitioners. We should view everyone as same. So when we say Mahayana and all this, we are not saying that they are lower vehicle, but it's just that the term is such that, you know, Mahayana and Hinayana. But nowadays, Hinayana, people hardly use that.
Mm-hmm.
His Holiness uses the term, the Sanskrit tradition and Pali tradition. Got follower of Sanskrit tradition and follower of Pali tradition.
Mm-hmm.
So the other term used is Theravada. But Theravada is only one set of Hinayana tradition. At the moment, there's only that is alive now. That tradition is alive. So we are using that. But technically, that is not right. Not right. But we try not to use the Hinayana. But it doesn't mean that there is this difference. There is a difference. And also, when we say, when we acknowledge the proclivity, when we acknowledge the mental disposition, it doesn't mean that we are putting them down. You need to know the other's mental disposition so that you can teach or you can help according to their taste and their mental capacity. So it is very clear in the teachings that we should not say, oh, I am Mahayana, you are Theravadin. Never to treat that way. That is very clear. Did I understand you?
Yes, okay. Yes, you did.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah, but it's very important, I think.
Yes.
To a lot of people who want to practice Mahayana tradition, they don't want to see others as less than themselves.
Yes, yes, of course not. That's why we say that we have to look. Remember, we covered that others are also, all sentient beings are equal from their side. So we have to have this attitude towards all sentient beings. We don't talk about the practice, all this. Just from their own side, just like me, they want happiness. They are seeking happiness. Just like me, they want to avoid suffering. So if we are able to look from this lens of common humanity, so that's the whole practice is about. We are not discriminating. We are not saying another is better than the other one. We are not saying that. We are acknowledging that people have different mental capacity. Yeah.
Thank you.
May I also offer another idea?
Sure.
That I often think of them and use the Taoist symbol,
mm-hmm.
the yin and yang.
Mm-hmm.
Not so much that they're specifically yin or yang, but the idea that as you move deeply into something, it transitions into the other, it has the seed within it. And
yes.
I think similarly, whether we follow the Mahayana or the Pali or the Sanskrit, that it, as people move deeply enough into them, they will find the seeds of the other eventually, right?
Yeah.
So it can take even yet another step away from the, okay, I'm not discriminating, but it's still different.
And one time His Holiness mentioned this, because sometimes they have this view that, you know, oh, Mahayana, this one. So people think that we are completely following a different, you know, set of path and all that. So when His Holiness met with this Theravada great teacher, so His Holiness discussed with him about this Vinaya, on the topic of Vinaya, when His Holiness explained that, oh, we follow this and this, he was so surprised that the Tibetan Buddhism practiced this.
Right.
Yeah, but that is the foundation. All of the monastic vows and all this based on Theravada's text.
Right.
So it is not that, you know, Mahayana is completely isolated, Hinayana is completely, you know, this side. It's not. It's all this, especially when we are doing this bodhicitta. You need to know all that. Otherwise, how are you going to help all that people with different mental capacities? If you are trained in only one set of practices, then you will be able to have only that set of that group of people, whereas you won't be able to help all. Yeah.
I was reading on where it said that in the age of law, or, you know, appropriate causes and conditions, that no discrimination is needed. You could have equanimity, but in a degenerate age where the law is completely lawless, basically, then it's almost a duty to discriminate.
Duty to discriminate? Yeah. I don't know what that is.
Mm. Discriminate in the sense of people's actions, not the view in the person, as you explained, makes really perfect sense to me. Because it's the distinction of view and person. And if you don't, if you're not judging a person, but you're judging their behaviors or their lawfulness, I think that's it's in the. And the other thing that I wanted to say is that the inner mixing of the worldly concerns with Dharma practice. There's traditions that actually do that. I mean, in the Kagyu tradition, for instance, I think that you know, Marpa was an example of that. And that can
sorry, Marpa is example
of mixing the worldly concerns with Dharma. You know, because his lifestyle, he was just a regular person.
No. Okay, I need to correct you there. So worldly concern, yeah, it doesn't mean that you lead a lay person's life. It doesn't mean that.
Yes, I know that.
Marpa is a lay person.
It's how was I explained? You have one foot in the world and you have one foot in your Dharma practice.
No, that's not worldly concern. You can have live a completely, what do you call, lay person's life, but you can be untainted, uncontaminated by all these eight worldly concerns. So worldly concern doesn't mean that you live a worldly kind of lay person's life. That's not. Even we are monks, but if we are not careful, our motivation, if I teach here today, and I teach here with, oh, you know, I want to teach so that, you know, I will have more students, so that, you know, people will praise me. Even though I am not a lay person, but I'm contaminated by lay, what called the worldly concerns. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyone? Yes.
Well, I'll go back to the idea of different capacities. It's always been impressed upon me that I try to remember this all the time, is that when I engage in, it's obvious to me, of course, when I engage in a puja practice or going through sadhana, there's a progression there. That we start out with the basic, go for refuge. We say seven-limb prayer. We do, eventually then you go and you do purification, you make prostrations and this sort of thing. Those are all, and you go do those mindfully. And it doesn't matter that you're Mahayana, or, you know, you're doing them because they're progressing you into where you're going with that practice. And eventually, you are actually doing a tantric practice. You still start out at the same place and work your way through to that. You don't say, okay, I'll get this out of the way now and I can do this advanced thing. It reminds you all the time that you're part of a continuum.
Yes, yes, yes. Yeah, if I may say, but of course, whatever we do, whether it becomes, remember in Lamrim we talk about this, three scopes, three practitioners. So one, the person, let's put it this way, the small scope practice, medium scope practice, then the great scope practice. So there are different types of practices, but what becomes of these practices is all depends on your motivation. So if your motivation to do any practice, let's put it this way, your motivation of doing practice is motivated by simply achieving or ensuring a good rebirth, so that practice is just the practice of small scope. Then, further to that, just ensuring a good rebirth in the future is not that great, because next life you still are unsure. Your next rebirth is still uncertain. So, until and unless I am free from all these afflictive emotions, I won't have real freedom. So with that intention, you aspire to achieve liberation from samsara. And then whatever practice that is motivated by that intention becomes the practice of medium scope. That is also that kind of motivation we can call also motivated by renunciation. And then the Mahayana, the motivation, whether it becomes a Mahayana practice or not, it is all depend on whether you have this, the motivation of bodhicitta, to achieve enlightenment in order to benefit sentient beings. So that's why we always, I mean, all our prayers begin with this generation of bodhicitta. That is why, because that differentiates our practice. And then, of course, in the text, it says that if you do with that kind of intention, it is more meritorious than simply a wish to achieve a good rebirth. Yeah. So practice goes there, but our intention plays a role. So what practice you want to do depends on your motivation.
I have a question. That intention is related to the previous life's karma also, because less karma, so they don't want to be as an upper vehicle. They don't have that mental capacity to think of others, just myself, liberation. It's a matter of how you can shoulder a luggage. If someone shoulder bigger,
exactly.
If you can shoulder lesser weight, it's
different, but not to look at as a
good or bad, or yeah, greater or worse, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it is all about, all depends on your capacity. If you have this capacity to think about, you know, benefiting others, that's good. But if you don't have that capacity, if you are only concerned about achieving liberation, that is also good. So we are not saying that that is really bad. We are saying that's good. As long as you are doing something, as long as you are practicing. Mm.
May I say something else too?
Sure.
In the Lamrim, it's pretty clear, at least to me, that when you arrive to, or if you are this way from the get-go, you still have to know all the other practices. And I know sometimes it's not the case. Sometimes people arrive, oh, I'm this, I'm that, and they don't know anything about the other ones, and they don't do it. And so it's very important to know the entire path.
Yeah. Agree. Okay, what time is it? Oh, it's already time's up. Okay, let's do the recitation together. This recitation.
Okay.
Yeah.
By thinking of all sentient
beings as more precious than a wish-fulfilling jewel, for accomplishing the highest aim, I will always hold them dear. Whenever I am in the company of others, I will regard myself as the lowest among all. And from a very depth of my heart, may I hold others as supreme. In every action, I will watch my mind, and as soon as affliction arises, since it dangers myself and others, may I confront it strongly and avert it. Whenever I see ill-natured people or overwhelmed by harm, I will cherish them as something rare, as though I found a priceless treasure. Whenever someone out of envy does wrong by attacking or belittling me, I will take defeat upon myself and give the victory to others. Even when someone I have helped or in whom I place great hopes mistreats me very unjustly, I will view that person as a true spiritual teacher. In brief, directly or indirectly, I will offer help and happiness to all my mothers, and secretly take upon myself all their hurt and suffering. I will learn to keep all these practices untainted by thoughts of the eight worldly concerns. May I recognize all things alike illusion,
and without attachment gain freedom.
Okay.
So we should say the dedication prayer is beginning with the short mandala offering on page 4, and then the concluding prayer is staying on page, starting on page 6. Where's the remote? I can't reach it. That's all right.
Chūshī mēdō dhamā rīrā līngshī nīndē yīmbā dē sāngjī jīnlā mīdē bīvāyī rūgī nāmdā jīnlā chūbārā shō yedāṅ gūrū rā nāyā dāyā mē rīmbā jī mājī bānā jī jūrū jī kīvā nyāmbā mīvā Kone kondo bewa sho Jetsu labi kutze labdenche Namga chile chuchu yipada Losan tenbe jome sasungi Kyowe mutsu tatu ne yuchi Kangri rawe korwe shinkande Pendam dewa madu jume ne Chile siwan tenzin yasui Shabe sute bardo ten yuchi Jampel Pavu Chita Chemba Dan Kunzo Sambo Deya Nishinti Tila Gunji Jesu Dalo Che Yewa Dila Tamche Tatu Tasum Shepi Gyawa Tamche Ki Noa Kala Choto Mapadi Tagi Gewe Tawan Rikun Gyam Sambo Chuchi Ratu Mowar Chi